You're listening to audio from The Village Church. This teaching is designed to be listened to after having completed the lesson in the workbook. It is not intended to stand alone. You can download the workbook at tvcresources.net.
This is Ina Carruth. She is going to be teaching you this morning. And I know you may be wondering, well, if you're physically present, why is Ina going to be doing the lesson? Ina is wondering that herself, actually. When I texted her, I can't wait for you to teach, she was like, wait, you're going to be there? So I thought I should probably clarify that a little bit. For those of you who are not familiar with Ina, Ina is the lead teacher over at our Plano campus in their women's Bible class, and they are sharing her with us this week. I don't know if you know this, but there are about 230 women who meet over there each Tuesday morning and Tuesday evening to do the exact same thing that we are doing here. Ina has been my friend and compatriot for these many long years now. She started as a small group leader for me, and then one day came and said, you know, I think I want to teach. I think I want to do this and just gather some women in my living room. And her living room got too small for those women. And at the point that the Plano campus decided to start doing women's Bible class, Ina basically was able to just start it. She just brought that living room right into the local church. And yeah, it is, I'm giving you the short version. Like, it makes me get a little choked up when I think about it.
Don't make me cry.
She would come over and listen. She would put together her teaching notes. I'm like, here's what we're going to do. You're going to put together your teaching notes. And then she would come and sit and listen to me teach in the morning. And then she would go and teach in her living room at night. And so I don't know if you guys are aware that this happens with us, but I don't want this to be the Jen show. Like, that's my worst nightmare, is that everybody would only want to come to this to hear what I have to say. And that's why we talk about active learning environments all the time, and that it's on you as a student to own the text. And so Ina is an example of someone who sat there and thought, I think I could do that if I could get some help. And that's what we've tried to do. And Ina's raised up teachers over at the Plano campus. The church should be a place where women who have an ability and an interest to teach are being cultivated. In a church our size, it can be a difficult thing to do. But I am so thrilled that she has come alongside of me in ministry, and you're going to be blessed to hear her teach today. And I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jen. Oh, my gosh. I'm going to just put that aside. Okay, so Jen told you a little bit about me, but let me tell you some things about her first, because that just feels right. You know that she is an incredible, ferocious teacher of God's Word, and that she's been my teacher, too, for the past 8 years. But I just want to say God has used her to profoundly impact my knowledge of who He is. And not just through her teaching, but through her friendship and through her life lived out. She has equipped me, and she has given me courage. She has taught me how to write curriculum and how to teach the Bible line by line. And she told me something really profound that she just alluded to. But she said when we started our campus, you don't want me on a screen. Someone can do it. And so she has just been a champion of women and just people using their gifts in the local church. And that's really important, I think, in the culture that we have. And so she's been a champion for biblical literacy, and just her persistence in that and God's grace in that is why we get to open our Bibles here this morning, and why that is that's happening as well across our campuses. That's exciting for men and for women. And so, Jen, thank you. So let's turn to Matthew. Let's do it. You guys have done your homework. You have sat in small group and had meaningful discussion about the text. Where if I were a betting person, I bet you spent some time talking about what binding and loosing mean. And like, what's happening with the transfiguration, right? So let's get to it. We are 16 chapters in to Matthew, and it's clear to us that Jesus Christ is the Messiah. Matthew began his narrative with that statement in the genealogy. Jesus has demonstrated through his teaching and through his miracles that he is the fulfillment of all of the Old Testament promises and prophecies. And as we progress in the book, we are seeing that there's this growing divide in people's response to Jesus. They believe in faith, they might doubt, or show unbelief. And as that gap widens, what we're going to see is Jesus is going to draw in his disciples, and he is going to teach them what it means to follow him. And we're going to see that in chapter 16 through 20. Now, last week, you guys had a trail of breadcrumbs, right? Running through the text. Each part was leading to a clearer picture of who Jesus is, his true identity. So you saw him miraculously feed people in a desolate place. And what he was doing was showing that he was a new and better Moses sent to save God's people. You saw Jesus walk on water, showing his dominion, not just over creation, but over chaos and over darkness. And he said this to Peter, "Take heart, it is I." We talked about that. Literally, he said, "I am." He's saying something about his divine nature. And then we saw the Canaanite woman, her beautiful faith, that she identified Jesus correctly as the Son of God, right? And he praised her for her faith. And then he went on to feed 4,000 Gentiles. And so what Jesus is showing us there is he's not just King of Israel. He is King of the world. And so each picture is clearer and clearer as we get into the text. But up to this point in the narrative, Jesus has not explicitly acknowledged the fullness of who he is. So this week is a climax where the trail of breadcrumbs has turned into just bread chunks. Have you ever fed ducks with a toddler or with a kid and you're trying to like, hey, just break it off, you know, and they just either eat it or just toss it, right? That's what's happening. We are getting these huge bread chunks as the disciples are discovering really what the true identity is of Christ in our text this week. And so let's get after it. Chapter 16, verse 13. "Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, 'Who do people say that the Son of Man is?'" Now, the first thing I want you to notice is the location on the map. Caesarea Philippi, you have a map in the back of your workbook. That is the northernmost point on the map, and that is with great intention, because this part of the narrative is a climax moment, not just in the narrative, but geographically. So just keep that in mind. And as Jesus asks this question, what he's doing is he is inviting his disciples to see him more clearly. Jesus is pressing on his disciples to consider the response to his ministry. He has not used the title Messiah to describe himself yet. He's left the crowds to draw their own conclusions about this unique authority that he demonstrates, right? And it's been a mixed bag. We've seen belief, we've seen doubt, we've seen unbelief. But think about where the disciples have been. They have been in and among the people as he's been teaching, and they have been privy to see all of his miracles. So this question makes sense. Jesus is basically like, hey, what's the word on the street about me? And he's intentional, right? He's asking this question, inviting them to see something more about himself. And he's really the best storyteller, because did you notice in our text, he refers to himself as Son of Man 5 times in our text today. And that question, that title, Son of Man, invites us to ask the question of who. Son of Man is a bit ambiguous, right? It kind of leaves you guessing. And this is matching the response of the people who are still struggling to understand Jesus' identity. So let's go to verse 14. "And they said," some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, others say Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. We answer this in our homework. What do all the people have in common that he named? They're prophets, right? One who has spoken for God with divine purpose. And Jesus himself did associate himself with the prophets. In Matthew 12, he said, "Someone greater than Jonah is here." But to say that he's just a prophet falls short, right, of who he really is. It's an incomplete understanding. And so the disciples aren't wrong. They're not wrong, but it's just it's lacking a full picture. It's not enough to get it partially right. And mistaken identity is a big problem for them, but it is for us too. And I get to experience this daily because I have twin boys that are 6 years old. And they are in kindergarten, Will and Shepherd, and they look the same. They look very, very similar. And they are in separate classrooms so that they can get an education and not slide tackle each other all day. Anybody with boys can relate to that. So last month I got a call from one of their teachers, which is never fun. Saying, "Hey, we're having a problem at school, and I just wasn't sure if this happened at home." Okay. And so she proceeded to tell me that Shepherd was getting disciplined in PE. And when the coach came up and was correcting him, he said, "I'm not Shepherd, I'm Will." Right? Played that card way too early. I'll be teaching a parenting class right after this. So he's getting disciplined. He's saying, "I'm not Shepherd, I'm Will." And so I'm like, this actually doesn't happen at home because I know them. They have different voices. They have different skills. One of them is street smart. One of them is book smart. They like different things. They have different preferences. That can never happen at home because I know them. But it can easily happen at school because they look the same, right? When the PE teacher was saying, when the PE teacher was disciplining them, he believed Shepherd because he doesn't know him. And this is kind of at where the disciples are at and where the audience is at. Up to this point in the narrative, they have not had clarity. They're getting closer, but they don't get it yet until now. So listen to this next question Jesus says in 15. He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Again, he's extending this invitation for his disciples to see him clearly. And he expects that they have a more accurate understanding than the people in the crowds, right? They've seen everything. They've seen all the teaching. They've seen all the miracles. And look who replies, their leader, Simon Peter. Now, I want to take a minute. I think we need to push back on this caricature that I think that we have of Peter, that he is rash and bold, that he never thinks things through, and he's kind of all over the map, because I'm just not sure that that's exactly who Matthew shows him to be. He is the leader, and as the leader, he speaks for everyone in the group. But it's clear that he himself has put more of the puzzle pieces together about correctly discerning who Christ is. And here's the climax, verse 16. Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Okay, this is not simply a title, a name. It is a title, meaning anointed one, chosen one. You saw that in your homework. But it carries with it these connotations of deep hope. The human deliverer God would send to his people. Generation after generation of Israelites waited on the edge of their seat to see who the Messiah would be. And in fact, this title is so important that as you read through the Bible, as you read through the New Testament, particularly the epistles, they never refer to Jesus as simply Jesus. They always refer to him as Jesus Christ, because he cannot be separated from this title of hope that comes with his name. Now, we are very familiar with him, or we think that we are, so we kind of treat Christ like it's a last name, like, hey, we know him, we don't have to call him by his last name. But no one would ever do that in that time. The original audience would have never done that, because it carries with it this deep connotation of hope. We have 20/20 vision, right? We get to look back on the cross. We have that privilege, so we know the story. But the people of the original audience and the disciples themselves didn't. They experienced waiting. They anxiously awaited to who this Messiah would be. So what Peter was saying when he said Jesus was the Christ, that he is the Christ, is that he is the fulfillment. That's one of the themes in the book of Matthew. He is saying, you are the fulfillment of thousands of years of history. He was the one they had been anticipating since the fall in Genesis 3, since Genesis 12, when God made those promises to Abraham that through him would come blessing, from 2 Samuel 7:14, when God made a promise to King David that a king would sit eternally on his throne. There's a buildup here that gets lost on us sometimes. Jesus is the Messiah. He was the one that the prophets pointed the nation of Israel to as they called the people back out of disobedience to the promises of God. And the only hope that the Israelites had in the 400 years of silence and oppression and exile was that God hadn't forgotten them, that he would send a Messiah. And so there is so much weight here. But look at this added dimension, because he's not simply Jesus Christ, he is the Son of the living God. And what this adds is another dimension. It shows us that God is not just this abstract idea, but he is the dynamic God of Israel's faith and history. Let's see what Jesus says. Verse 17, and Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Now notice, Jesus uses Peter's full name there, Simon Barjona, or son of Jonah, to add weight to what just happened. Now some of you might still have PTSD of your parents using like your full name, because what did it mean? You're in trouble, right? But sometimes we use that. I use Charlotte's full name all the time when I take her little face in my hands and I'm like, I am Charlotte Marie Caruth, I am so proud of you. Thank you so much for taking care of your brothers and sisters while I have been missing in action with my nose in my Bible. Like, this was that whole last week. But using a full name, it adds weight. That's what Jesus is doing here. He's commending Peter for nailing it, for putting those pieces of the puzzle together to see that Jesus was the one that they were waiting for. But how is this possible? Like, where did this knowledge come from? Not from Peter's natural ability to think and process information, but from the Father who is in heaven. And we've talked about this before in chapter 11. Spiritual insight comes from God. Spiritual revelation about God comes from him. Verse 18, and I tell you, Peter, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And so Peter has made a declaration about Christ, and in turn, Jesus makes a declaration about Peter. And if you looked at the original language, you would see some symmetry there between what Peter says about Jesus and what Jesus says about Peter. Basically, Jesus says, yes, Peter, you're right. And since you know who I am, I'm going to tell you who you are. So who is Peter? Jesus is giving him a new name here, Peter, meaning rock, right? So far, Matthew has referred to Peter as Simon throughout this whole gospel. But right now in verse 18, we get to go back and be like, well, how'd he get that name? This is it. Verse 18. So the name Peter means rock. And this was virtually an unknown as a personal name. So Jesus wasn't super hip. He wasn't giving Peter a name like Apple or Denim. And I love that I'm cracking a joke about this because I have a son named Shepherd. But let's move on. He intentionally uses wordplay to explain Peter's role. He is to be a rock. And we learned in chapter 7 that one critical function for a rock is for building, to build a foundation upon, right? So Jesus is communicating that about Peter, I will build my church. And not only that, it will be eternally secure. Jesus is going to start using all of this imagery about building. Rock, foundation, keys, to paint a picture of his church. So Jesus gives us another truth in that verse. He says that the gates of hell won't prevail against it. Did you wonder what that meant? I did. Well, it's a metaphor for death. Gates of hell is a metaphor for death. In other words, Jesus is pointing to this truth that death itself will not be able to touch this new community, this new people, his church, because it's an everlasting one. So he's already pointing forward to the resurrection. Verse 18. I'm going to repeat that. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you keys to the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. So who's the active party here? It's Jesus, right? Did you hear that repeated language? I will build my church. It's his church. He's the one that will build, and he is the one who gives the keys to Peter, right? And so this metaphor is meant to draw out that Peter is a steward. He's not the owner. Just because you have keys doesn't mean you're the owner, right? Like you probably had a set of keys to your house growing up, but you likely weren't paying the mortgage. So Peter is a steward, and as such, he has this authority concerning the church. And so what was this responsibility? His responsibility was to do whatever it took to open the doors to the kingdom of heaven and establish its ways on earth. Okay, let's talk about binding and loosing, because I thought this was confusing. I didn't know what it meant until I really dug into the text. So what's Jesus talking about? This language was used by rabbis in rabbinic circles. And what it was the authority to declare what was and what was not permissible. This isn't talking about people's entrance to heaven, okay? This isn't like Peter at the pearly gates, jingling keys around. That's really a misunderstanding of what the kingdom of God is, that it's just this abstract idea that it exists in heaven. It's God's rule among his people in heaven and on earth, okay? And so this isn't about people's entrance to heaven. Binding and loosing is the authority to settle issues of the church. That's what Jesus is pointing to. Binding and loosing is the authority to settle issues of the church. And what this isn't a holy endorsement of whatever Peter's feeling that day. But rather, it carries the idea that Peter will be so aligned with the Lord that when he makes a decision on earth concerning the church, it will have already been made in heaven. So this is a guarantee of divine guidance for Peter, that he's going to be so aligned with God's thinking that it will seem as though what he does on earth is sealed in heaven, when in reality, it's the other way around. And so the heart of Peter's role is to usher in that prayer of Matthew chapter 6, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So Jesus Christ, in this passage, he has revealed himself as Messiah, and as such, he is the head of the church, and he is responsible for building it and for making it an everlasting one. But the implications are for Peter too, right? He also is a builder. He's the rock and the foundation, but he's not the owner. He is a steward. And his responsibility is to open the doors to the kingdom of heaven and establish its ways on earth. So let's get to verse 20. Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he is the Christ. Like, why not? Isn't this good news? Wasn't Peter right? Yeah, he was. But there was a lot of potential misunderstandings with this title of Messiah. The majority of the Jews would have associated that as a political term, and they would have assumed that he was coming to free them from Roman rule and to return Israel to the state of flourishing. So they really would have pictured Rome in ashes and then Jesus sitting on an earthly throne. And so he didn't want to be misunderstood. So the time wasn't right. So he said not to tell, verse 21. From that time on, Jesus began to show the disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And so make a note in your text, because on verse 21, from that time on, that's the beginning of Jesus's fourth block of teaching in the book of Matthew. The way that he structured it was to be these five blocks of teaching, another way that Matthew was showing him to be a new revealer of the law of God. And so we've seen the climax, this correct identification of who Jesus is, and that was at the northernmost point in his journey. This is a hinge verse, because at this point forward, everything is going south towards Jerusalem, and there is a shadow looming over this journey that Christ is about to take. Verses 21 through 28 are all about preparation. He is preparing the disciples for mounting conflict. But listen, he's also inviting them to look beyond his suffering and death, and he is preparing them for an accurate estimation of what it really looks like to follow him. And so who is Jesus? Jesus is the Christ. He is the Messiah. What are the implications of his identity? Suffering and death. So we have to hear this like the disciples would have. We have to feel how they felt. They were devastated. They could not wrap their mind around what he just said. The closer they've gotten to the identity of Christ, the closer they have also gotten to the dark and mysterious plan of God. We have to put aside this hindsight 2020 vision and experience this with them to keep us from judging them too harshly. We have to sit in this darkness and confusion with them. The sadness of Good Friday, right? We can't fast forward to Easter quite yet. We see this implication of Jesus's role as Messiah. He's not just to suffer and die, but did you hear what he said? He's also to be raised. But this part, they almost, it's like they didn't hear it. All they heard was death and suffering. That's what stayed with them. Look at verse 22. We know that because of what Peter says here. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." And so he's the spokesman, and he jumps in first saying, "This is horrifying. We don't want this to happen to you. This is not going to happen." And things get pretty intense because Peter rebukes Jesus, and it's really hard to fathom the amount of boldness that it took for him to make that statement. That word for rebuke is a strong one. It's Jesus did this in Matthew chapter 8 when he told the wind and the waves to be still. So that there's really strong language being used here. It conveys this shock. It's not just unwelcome news. This is unthinkable. Strong words from Peter and even stronger from Jesus. But he turned and he said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." So Jesus is basically like, "Not today, Satan." So we've kind of turned that into like this funny thing that we say, but Jesus like really is not joking at all. He is not joking. There isn't a parallel for calling another human being Satan. So this would have been crushing to him. But why is he doing this? Why is he going for the jugular here and calling Peter Satan? Think about Matthew chapter 4. Think about the temptations that Jesus was tempted with by Satan, particularly the third one, an easy path to glory. This is the same temptation that Peter was offering him, unknowingly, he didn't have impure motives. But Jesus heard what was being offered and he rejected it. He said, "You're a hindrance to me, you're an offense to me, you're a stumbling block to me, and I'm not gonna trip over you, Peter, rock, so get behind me so I don't." And so now we're gonna see Jesus's heart in this verse. And his heart is really to align the thinking of the disciples with the thinking of God. And so he's gonna draw out two fundamental truths. There's just two ways to think about things, like God does or like man does, like heaven or like earth, right? These contrasting realms that is just woven throughout Matthew's gospel. Peter is speaking from a limited scope. He's human. He doesn't know everything. But God is not limited in scope, and his plan is seen from eternity, right? He existed within eternity before he ever invented time. Let me read to you the words of Isaiah chapter 55, 8 and 9. "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, declared the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts are higher than your thoughts. This isn't a simple discrepancy between man's thinking and God's thinking. This is diametrically opposed ways, okay? It's a big, big difference. And so Peter is the rock, right? He's the foundation. Jesus has already said, I'm going to build my church on you, Peter. But will God build his church on a rock that doesn't believe in the death and resurrection of Christ? And that's kind of where Peter is right now. Jesus has to keep this line of thinking in check because it's a human line of thinking and it can stand in the way of God's purposes and derail it. And so again, Jesus's heart is to align the disciples' thinking with the heart of God. And that's why we're in this room, right? That's why we're here, so we can set our mind on the things of God. That's why I'm here. I need my mind to be aligned with the things of God because we're forgetful. We need our minds to be renewed so that we're not conformed to the world, but rather we're conformed to Christ. And so who is Jesus? Jesus is the Christ. He is the Messiah. What are the implications of his identity? Suffering and death. But a new question, what are the implications for the disciples? And Jesus is going to draw this out in verses 24 through 26. Then he told the disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? And so Jesus is drawing out what it means to follow him. And this is the ultimate reality check. It's self-denial and cross-bearing. I think there's a temptation here for us to immediately apply this to our lives and say that Jesus wants us to pick up our crosses daily and be patient with our kids and do our work with joy and drive without road rage. And I think he does want all of those things. But he is talking about something very serious here. Jesus is talking about nothing less than death. He's drawing on this imagery of the Roman custom of taking up the horizontal beam of the cross and carrying it to the place of execution. So we need to hear it like the disciples did. Jesus is not speaking in metaphors here. He is preparing the disciples for potential martyrdom, and he's not glorifying death. Jesus hates death. That's why he came. But he's preparing his disciples to understand this. He wants his disciples and us to align our thinking with the thinking of God. Okay, he's deconstructing their understanding of the world and reassembling it with according to the kingdom values. And what kind of kingdom does Jesus have? It's an upside-down kingdom, right? It's a paradox. So he's saying there are two ways. There are two competing realms, two kingdoms. There is heaven and there is earth. There is God's thinking and man's thinking. There is thinking with eternity in mind, and there is thinking of the here and now. There is treasure in heaven or there is treasure on earth. You can risk everything to follow Jesus, or you can try and save yourself, self-preservation. But the bottom line really is the life we want to protect can't save us. Self-preservation actually isn't safe because in the midst of it, you forfeit your soul. I think the words of Matthew chapter 6 keep coming to mind here. Don't seek worldly possessions and power at the expense of everlasting treasure. Self-preservation leads to destruction, but self-denial and cross-bearing leads to fulfillment. And think about this. We can't possibly align ourselves with God's thinking and live out this costly life of discipleship unless we have an accurate understanding of who Jesus Christ really is. And so I want us to notice the flow of the text with Jesus and Peter and the disciples. Peter correctly identifies Jesus as the Christ. And in turn, Jesus tells Peter what is true about Peter. He gives him an identity. He gives him a purpose. He gives him a hope. His identity is this. Peter is the rock. He is a builder of the kingdom. His mission, his purpose is to do whatever it takes to open the doors to the kingdom of heaven and establish its ways on earth. His hope is that death will not overcome God's kingdom, that it's an everlasting one. And then as Jesus explains his identity, who he is, the implications of his suffering and death, it adds weight to the disciples' identity, mission, and hope. So who are the disciples? They are builders of the kingdom. They are followers of Jesus. Their mission to do whatever it takes to open the doors of the kingdom of heaven and establish its ways on earth, to deny themselves and pick up their cross, even if it means their death. And what is their hope? that death will not overcome God's kingdom, and that in losing their life for the sake of Christ, they will find an everlasting one awaiting them. So a correct understanding of Christ informed Peter's identity and the disciples, but he does that for us. We can't have true knowledge of ourselves without true knowledge of Jesus Christ. It is the knowledge of Christ that informs our identity, our mission, and our hope. Listen to this. What is our identity? We are builders of the kingdom. We are followers of Jesus. We are accepted and adopted into God's family. And this is a picture of our justification. What is our purpose? What is our mission? To do whatever it takes to open the doors of the kingdom of heaven and establish its ways on earth, to deny ourselves and pick up our crosses, even if it means our death, and to be conformed to the likeness of Christ and set apart for his purposes. And that's a picture of our sanctification, being set apart for God. And what is our hope? Our hope is that we eagerly await the return of King Jesus, that death will not overcome God's kingdom, that if we lose our lives for the sake of Christ, we will find an everlasting one awaiting us. And that is the hope of our glorification. In his book, The Cost of Discipleship, it's great. Dietrich Bonhoeffer says this: when Christ calls a man, he bids him to come and die. So Jesus wants his disciples and us to understand the reality of the hard path. He wants us, though, to also look beyond suffering and death and to see that though Jesus suffer and die, in the world to come, it will be in an upturned upside down, right? The glory and reward lie in the future, when Jesus' reign is full and complete. And he has a lot to say about that hope in verses 27 and 28. All right, let's go to him. For the Son of Man is going to come with angels and in his glory of the Father, and then repay each person according to what he has done. Truly, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And so this is a glorious hope being offered here. Verse 27 is this vision of the future when Christ returns in his second coming and when his reign is full and complete. And so he's drawing out, hey, it's worth being faithful to the end. Even regardless of the cost, it is worth it because judgment is coming. And did you notice who the judge was? The Son of Man, Jesus Christ. And it's in the outcome of that judgment where true life is found, where Christ will account to us his righteousness, right? Be faithful. This isn't the end. This is a call to hope, but it's also a warning, right? It's a warning to remain loyal to Christ. And then in verse 28, we see that we're introduced to this timeline. So when is this supposed to happen? Another way to read verse 28 is there are those standing here who will not taste death is to say there are those standing here who are still alive. And we see that as we move into our next text, which is the transfiguration, that they get a foretaste of what will one day be in full in the glorious transfiguration. So let's move on to that. Okay, before we do though, so there's two kinds of people in the world, right? Those who can slip into a movie theater like right before the movie starts and miss all the previews, or those who like intentionally get there in time so they can see all of them. For me, if I miss a preview, I just don't want to go to the movie. I want the whole thing. So the whole point of a preview is to draw us in, right? It's to give us a piece of the story so that we want to see the rest of the movie. And that's what Jesus has been doing, right? He has been giving us a foretaste. He's been giving us a preview of what the kingdom of heaven is like in his teaching, in his miracles. Now, he's also given the disciples a pretty accurate preview of what it's going to take to follow him. And that movie was a scary one, right? They were like, ooh, I don't know if I want to see that. But he's like, no, the end is great. Stay with me here, right? The end is great. But we get another preview here in the Transfiguration, and it is a glorious one, and it reveals the divine nature of Christ. So let's keep going, chapter 17. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain. And so Jesus is bringing just three, his inner three. And did you notice who's among them? Peter. Peter is among them. He still gets to partake in this beautiful manifestation of the glory of Christ. And something I think God wants to draw our attention to is that his grace is never too far behind his judgment. God's grace is never too far behind God's judgment. And I want you to know that because it's a theme throughout the scriptures. Peter's failure does not disqualify him. He's still the leader of the 12. In the Gospels, Peter is named first among the 12 every single time. The only person mentioned more than Peter in the Gospels is Jesus. And Jesus Christ spoke to Peter more than he spoke to any of the other disciples. And we see that in the first 12 chapters of Acts that Peter's leadership is critical for the church. So despite Peter getting it wrong and needing to be corrected, the grace of God was not too far behind. And because of that, our failures, they don't have the last word. God's grace does. Praise his holy name, right? Okay, Jesus has not taken them, has taken them very far from everyday life. They're up a high mountain, right? To give this revelation. And I want you just to know this is the fifth mountain that the Lord Jesus Christ has ascended. And by the time we get all the way through this gospel, he will have gone up seven mountains. And that is a number that represents wholeness and completion. And so let's go to verse 2. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became bright white. So we define this in our homework. Transfiguration. It's this visual transformation, not really in a physical sense, but it's this added dimension of glory. And so the dullness of Jesus' earthly conditions had faded away, and the disciples are getting a sense of his true divine nature. And we can hear this echo, right, from the Old Testament, the book of Exodus. It wouldn't have taken the inner three or the original audience long to connect this event to Moses' experience with God on Mount Sinai when he received the law. And so make note of that. But it's not going to have to take them long to realize that or make that connection, because Moses just straight up shows up. Moses is there. Elijah's there. And in the Old Testament, both Moses and Elijah, their lives pointed forward to what the Messiah, to the Messiah. And here they are in a conversation with Jesus. And don't you just wish you knew what they were talking about? I do. I wish I knew. Like, how did they know it was Moses and Elijah? How did they know that? I don't know. Verse 3. Sorry, no help there. And behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with them. Verse 4. And Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it's good that we're here. If you wish, I will make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah. You got to love Peter. Type A, just making a plan, right? I can relate to this. So Peter is immediately moved into action. He starts like making these tents. It's not really clear why. Some commentators think that he's trying to make this mountaintop experience permanent. I think we can relate to this, right? We're like, oh, this is awesome. Let's stay here. Others say that he's trying to build these tents or booths because it's based on this Jewish tradition of the end times of God's kingdom coming. And he thinks that's happening because he's getting this vision of Moses and Elijah. And so he makes this plan. But regardless of what Peter's reason is, the central thrust of this text is this divine interruption from God. So Matthew here is using this literary device that if you were with a Joshua or James or Joshua or Judges or really any of the Old Testament, it's a chiasmus. And in the middle of this chiasmus, this literary device is the central thrust of what's the main point. The main and what's in the center is God speaking about Jesus. That's the main point. Let's go to verse 5. He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." Now, some commentators believe when Peter is moved to build these tents, that he's putting Jesus on par with the prophets. In other words, he's not acknowledging him for who he really is. And this is unthinkable to God. And I think this kind of makes sense because it's at this point that God interrupts Peter's plan with the same language from Jesus' baptism. He says, "This is my beloved son with whom I am well pleased." And so he is distinguishing Jesus Christ as his son. He's not just a prophet. He is my son. And God is explicitly saying, he is better than these great Old Testament servants of mine. He's greater than that. He's better than Moses. He's better than Elijah. He is my son. And then he says, listen to him. And I don't think it's simply because Peter has taken the mic here making his plan. I think it's because they needed to hear something. So think about this. What were they having a hard time accepting? What were the disciples having a hard time understanding from chapter 16? They needed to understand that suffering and death was a part of the path of the Messiah. And so God is saying, listen to Jesus. And it wraps up in this really beautiful, tender moment. Not yet. First, the disciples have to fall on their faces. That is the right response before God. Verse 6, when the disciples heard this, God's voice talking, they fell on their faces and they were terrified. But Jesus came and touched them and said, "Rise and have no fear." And when they lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. And so look at how this wraps up. Jesus alone is divine. That's what we see from the transfiguration. He alone is divine, and he is the one that remains. Moses and Elijah were only temporary. Jesus alone is to be listened to and to be obeyed. And Jesus alone can tell the disciples and us not to be terrified at the presence of God. Only Jesus can do that. Verse 9, and as they're coming down the mountain, Jesus commanded them, tell no one about this vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. Okay, why does Jesus want to keep this under wraps? Same reason as before. He wants to avoid misunderstanding. He does not want to be misunderstood. If people knew about the heavenly glory he beheld during the transfiguration, they would try to keep him from the cross, a destiny he knows cannot be avoided. And because his path is to suffer and die, the details of this transfiguration would really just be a hindrance. And I just want you to see at every turn, Jesus is trying to bring it back. Hey, this is my path. It's hard. But did you see what else he pointed to? His resurrection. He's always pointing to his resurrection. He's speaking with this confident expectation of what God will do. All right, verse 10. And the disciples asked him, then why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? And he answered them, Elijah does come and he will restore all things. But I tell you that Elijah has already come. And they did not recognize him, but they did to him whatever they pleased. Okay, so in verse 10, the disciples are changing the subject. They're like, okay, back in that vision with Elijah, what was that about? And Jesus is going to really use this as an opportunity just to bring it back to himself, just to bring it back to his path of suffering. But it makes sense. So they're asking him about this scriptural promise of the scribe that said Elijah would be part of the Messiah coming. And Jesus is like, yeah, the scribes were totally right about that. But they were wrong about something else. They were wrong because they did not recognize him when he came, and he was talking about John the Baptist. It just takes the disciples like a big old circle to get right back. Okay, that's what he was talking about. So John the Baptist came in the spirit of Elijah, and they didn't recognize him. And so Jesus, once again, did you see what he did in verse 12 at the end? So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. He's bringing it again back to this path that he has to walk. All right, so here we go. They're coming down the mountain, and there's like a scene. So much like Moses from Mount Sinai is coming down to the faithless Israelites, and it's just a mess. Jesus has come down the mountain to a crowd of unbelief. And it's kind of like if you've ever gotten to get out of town for a few days with your husband and you left your kids at home with the grandparents or a babysitter, and it's just a mess. There's like goldfish everywhere, Legos. It looks like a bomb went off. That's what Jesus is coming down off this mountaintop experience, and he is coming into a real situation here with his disciples and the crowd. So let's read it. Verse 14, and when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him, kneeling before him, and said, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he has seizures and he suffers terribly, for he often falls into the fire and oft in the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they couldn't heal him. And Jesus said, O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me. And he rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. All right, it's easy to see here. Jesus is super frustrated, right? He is frustrated, and he is exasperated at the crowd, actually, who expect these miracles from him. They're like, oh, your disciples couldn't do it. You do it. Help us. They have not yet grasped his identity, and they're still wanting miracles. But despite his frustration, I want you to see this. Despite his frustration, his compassion is not lacking. I need to read that again for myself. Despite his frustration, his compassion is not lacking, and he heals the boy miraculously, effortlessly. What this is a discipleship moment. Remember in chapter 10, Jesus has commissioned the disciples to do miraculous work. But it was conditioned upon their faith. And what Jesus wants to show them here is that they will never be able to not rely on their faith to establish the kingdom of heaven on earth. Because one day he won't be with them. He won't be with them. He's preparing them for this. And I love how the disciples like take him aside and they're like, hey, what happened back there? It didn't work out. And so he's going to use this as an opportunity to teach them. He says, it's because of your little faith. For truly, truly, I say to you, if you have faith like the grain of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. And nothing will be impossible for you. Okay, so let's go through this slowly because this can get confusing, I think. The issue here is not the amount of faith, but rather it is the object of faith. It is the object of faith. So unlike the crowds, the disciples did have faith, right? In chapter 16, it's the faith that allows them to see that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. But what happened was they took their eyes off the object of their faith, Jesus Christ. Maybe it was because he was up on the mountain with like their A-team, and so they were feeling insecure, or they thought they could just automatically access his power without prayer, without faith, without a dependence upon him. But either way, we need to understand that faith is not a measured commodity. It's found in a relationship. Faith is not a measured commodity. It is found in a relationship. The power of faith is in the person to whom it's directed. And so we see faith manifested in the actions of humble dependence, prayer, fasting. What is this text not saying? It is not saying that God will give us whatever we want. We've already talked about this in Matthew chapter 7. Jesus has clarified this himself. We are to ask, we are to seek, we are to knock. God is generous. He hears. He longs to provide spiritual provision for his children. We can always ask him for that. And so this isn't a holy endorsement when he says nothing will be impossible for you. It's not a holy endorsement to just ask him whatever we want, but it's to align our hearts with God. Faith isn't believing that God is at our service, that we can just ask him and he will, but rather that he knows what's best and he longs to provide for his children. All right, let's close this out. Verse 22. As they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. And they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." And they were greatly distressed. And so Jesus is deliberate. He is continuing to bring their attention back to the path that is before him. But there's something new in this text that I want you to see. It's a hint of betrayal. Jesus will be betrayed. He will be handed over and delivered into the hands of men. And so this is the first time that the disciples are kind of getting wind of that aspect. Jesus is inviting his disciples again to see beyond his rejection, beyond his suffering, beyond his death, into the hope of resurrection and glory. But their thinking is dominated with darkness, and they are greatly distressed, and they are exceedingly sorrowful, we see at the end. So we're 17 chapters into Matthew, and at this point, the disciples have the clearest picture of who Jesus Christ is. And the closer they've come to that, the deeper they have been drawn into this mysterious and dark plan of God. But the closer they've also come to understanding how God is going to redeem that path, right? They're beginning to see that their stories are bound up in the story of Jesus Christ. And like the disciples, our story is bound up into a greater story, the story of Jesus Christ. And so, how do we live in this broken world? How do we live with the reality of sin and suffering and death and everything that discipleship will cost us? Well, we remember that our story is wrapped up in a greater story, right? It was wrapped up in the story of Jesus Christ, in his life, in his death, and in his resurrection. And we rehearse again and again our identity, our mission, and our hope. We remember that we are accepted, we are adopted into the family of God, we are builders of the kingdom, we are followers of Jesus. And we remember what our purpose is, what our mission is here, to be conformed to his likeness and set apart for his glory, to do whatever it takes to open the doors of the kingdom of heaven on earth, to deny ourselves, to pick up our cross and to carry it, even if it means death. And we remember our hope. We remember and we eagerly await the return of King Jesus, that death will not overcome his kingdom, that if we lose our lives for the sake of Christ, we will find an everlasting one awaiting us. And so two questions just to leave with you before we close. How are you guilty of letting lesser things define you? Because Jesus has just defined a lot for who we are by telling us who he was. How are we guilty of letting the lesser things define us? Maybe it's a job or our family, our children, our marriage. Maybe it's our status. Maybe it's our failures, our bends, our struggles. And then the last thing is, what wrong expectations do you have about Jesus Christ? Because the disciples had some. What wrong expectations do you have about him in a life lived for him? The disciples were guilty of having these wrong expectations of Jesus Christ. They expected too much from him and yet not enough at the same time. They expected him to be an earthly king and to make their life an easy one, right? They expected too little of him because they weren't thinking with eternity in mind. And we're kind of guilty of the same thing. We have wrong expectations about Jesus Christ. We expect too much of him from him. We expect him to remove the trial and to remove the pain and to remove the suffering, to make our lives easier. I do sometimes. I'm very tempted to fall into that line of thinking in the here and now. And yet we expect too little from him. We underestimate the amount of spiritual provision that he gives in the midst of our life on earth. We underestimate his desire to grant salvation. And we underestimate what he is working in us and through us in the midst of that difficulty. I want to read a verse over us and then I'll pray. Galatians 2:20, words of Paul. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Let's pray. God, we love you so much. What a privilege to open up your word and to see so clearly who you are, Jesus. You are the Christ. You are the Messiah. You are the fulfillment of thousands of years of history. Jesus, we thank you for the dark path that you walked, that you died for sin and you rose again. We await your return, Lord. Give us endurance. Give us patience. And give us eyes to see what you are working in the difficulty. We love you and we praise you and we thank you. It's in your name that we pray. Amen.